And we'll move on to the fifth case for this morning, United States v. Gutierrez.
Good morning, honorable members of the court. May it please the court, Ms. Ruder. There were two seizures in this case. I'm concerning myself with the second one because that led to the recovery of the nearly 2 kilograms of cocaine in my client's home. That consent, it is our contention, was involuntary. It occurred after police, after conducting a 3-hour surveillance of my client and having observed him leave his car with a laundry bag and nothing else, asked to come into his home. My client allowed that. And a continuous prolonged detention occurred from that moment until the first recovery of cocaine on his person. That was a result of a purported consent by my client.
The facts certainly look like that, at least, was done by consent. They say, we'd like to search you, and he immediately puts his arms out.
That's not an involuntary consent. I agree with that.
You agree that as far as there, I mean, they go to the door, they knock, they say, can we come in? He says, yeah, come in. So we're still in a consensual world up to the point they're in the living room and they do the consensual search of him.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in this sense. He consented for their entry into the home. There's no question about that. He engaged, at least initially, with conversation with them. But then he walked away. And when he walked away, they followed him. At that point...
For the living room, right?
That's correct,
Your Honor. And he didn't make any indication that he didn't say, stay here, he didn't wave at them or anything. What indicates a limitation on the scope of his consent?
He asked them what they were doing there. Initially, he said, you know, what are y'all doing here? That is some sort of indication by my client that he questioned their presence, as well as walking away from them. Perhaps he didn't physically obstruct their presence or impede their continued presence, but he walked away, and that was his way of saying, hey, if I could use the vernacular, hey, I don't want anything to do with you.
But that's so odd. I mean, they're inside his house, and yes, I understand he turns and walks down the hallway to the living room, but leaving a bunch of police officers in your front hall while you walk away to some other part of the house is a very strange way of communicating, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. Wouldn't he have asked them to leave?
I think it's possible that my client, given his lack of education, given the fact that there were several officers there, was somewhat intimidated perhaps, and that he, panicked or was intimidated or couldn't communicate with them. He wasn't courageous enough to deal with a police presence. Some people, find it more difficult to deal with police officers, and I think that might be a possible explanation why he might have done that. But immediately the police officers asked him if he had contraband or weapons, and there was absolutely nothing to predicate that suspicion other than what they might have had when they could engage in their surveillance, but there's nothing objectively reasonable about that.
Do they have to have that kind of objective reasonableness for just questions they ask? I thought that this court in United States against Childs, which was an embanked decision, said conversation, questions, are not the kinds of things that trigger Fourth Amendment or other kinds of concerns.
That's correct, Your Honor. But my point is that at the beginning, it wasn't. It was consensual. They had every right to ask for entry. They had every right to engage in conversation, and my client willfully did so. But it became a point, and I know there's a short time span, I agree, before he consented to the search of his person. But during that interim period, the consensual encounter escalated by the question, do you have contraband or weapons, by his asking them what are they doing there.
That's the moment when you think this is transformed somehow from a consensual encounter into a non-consensual encounter?
That's correct, Your Honor. Because when they find the contraband on his person, they have probable cause to arrest him. There's no question about that. And so at that point, they can hold him. They found cocaine on his person. As a matter of fact, they can arrest him.
And that's when they take the handcuffs off and sit him back down again on the couch, right?
That's correct. And what's interesting is they don't remove him from the home. They continue questioning him and continue asking him to consent to the search of his home. After they've already conducted two cursory searches, protective searches, and came up with nothing, they then ask my client for a consent, which he refuses. They then obtain the consent by making two implied threats, and I don't mean physical threats. I mean the threat to call the U.S. Attorney's Office because they found cocaine on his person, which is kind of an idle threat because they were going to arrest him anyway.
Now, why is that a threat, and why is it something we ought to label with a pejorative word like threat if they explain to him, look, you can either consent or we'll go through the procedures and get a warrant, which they certainly could have done. I don't think that was an empty threat at all. I think it was a statement of fact, more or less.
I think, Your Honor, the reason that we should be concerned about it in this circuit is because the implication is that for a man of who's already scared because they found cocaine, probably scared because he has cocaine in his home, it implies that we'll let you go if you consent. Now, this wasn't said directly. I concede that, and I don't know if the officer really meant that. But you're giving that guy that's in that situation, you're threatening with something that you're going to do anyway. And he's going to consent, possibly thinking that, well, you know, if I consent, they might let me go for just, you know, a gram. It makes no logic because the officer should have just picked him up and taken him to the police station. Why they chose to leave him there and keep questioning him, it goes to what the United States versus but where the court said sometimes the encounters are prolonged so that it can develop into a situation where the client does consent. And I think that's what was happening here. They approached the home, and they knew that if they applied enough pressure, first they get the consent to enter, having no reason to enter to begin with. They then get him to consent to search his person. They don't remove him, and keep him there and pressure him by saying, we're going to call the U.S. Attorney's Office and then report the dope we found on your person, and then later say, we're going to get a search warrant anyway to search it. Those were intimidating factors that would lead someone of his background to then say, you got me. You know, after a passage of time, officers surrounding him, taking no for an answer. And I'm not saying that they pressured him in the sense that they physically pressured him, but they cuffed him, they uncuffed him, they moved him to the living room, they surround him. Eventually, he came to the consent request, which made it involuntary. So the second consent, I feel, is respectfully submit, is illegal because not only is a byproduct from the earlier detention that albeit it's a close call as to whether it rose to the level of a detention, but it certainly was for the second reason, and that is involuntary. Because, you know, they continue talking to him, and I think the Bennett factors, United States versus Bennett, would indicate, as well as Juraz, it's in his home. He can't refuse the request. He has no desire to leave his home. And it occurs at his they're surrounding him.
He does sign the form. He signs the Spanish version of this form.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct, but that comes after they make the, maybe not threats,
that's
maybe...
That's before the thorough search, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That turns up the couple of kilos.
That's correct. And that's after they've told him they were going to report him to the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's after he's refused once before.
It just sort of says, why are you doing this? You already searched, right? And then they explain to him, no, we were just doing our protective sweep.
That's correct. And it's interesting to note that, you know, he's observing these protective sweeps. That's another psychological ploy, that if you have cocaine in your home, you're already being told basically by those protective sweeps, and then with the threat that says, we're going to get a warrant anyway, you're cooked anyway.
Yeah.
That's why the consent...
In a word.
Yeah. So they were going to search anyway. That's what's that's the impression my client has. Had they arrested him for having cocaine on his person and taken him to a police station and booked him for it?
Okay.
Problem solved. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Martinez. Ms. Reuter?
Thank you. May it please the Court, Julie Reuter for the United States. I'd like to address several of the points made by defense counsel. First of all, when the agents approached Mr. Gutierrez's apartment on July 21, 2004, what Mr. Gutierrez said to them was, yeah, come on in. So when the agents then follow him into the kitchen and go straight, the record evidence was that it was a small apartment, and the door from the kitchen led directly into the living room. What the agents were doing was following through on the defendant's invitation to them into the home. Mr. Gutierrez is turning around and leading them to the living room was not, under any reasonable interpretation, an expression that he had changed his mind and did not agree that the agents could enter his house. That simply was not the context of entry into the residence.
And the agents were in uniform, right?
They were. They were wearing vests and jackets and other things that stated either police or customs. These were agents from the Immigration and Customs. Yes. Counsel stated that Mr. Gutierrez perhaps was intimidated or panicked, could not communicate with the officers. As the district court found, there isn't any question that this would be a stressful situation, particularly, as defense counsel points out, to someone who knows that he has cocaine both on his person and over his stove. But the focus here, as this court held in the Groff decision, is what the agents reasonably observed during their interactions with Mr. Gutierrez. Mr. Gutierrez did not appear to the agents to be unduly intimidated. They did not have the observation that Mr. Gutierrez was unable to communicate. The record shows that they had exactly the opposite impression, that they communicated freely with Mr. Gutierrez. His answers to them were sensible. He posed questions of his own, such as, what is it that you're doing here?
Was this communication all in English, or was it a combination of English and Spanish?
It was a combination. There were two ICE agents that were communicating with Mr. Gutierrez. The lead agent, Agent Hartnett, speaks English only, and he communicated with Mr. Gutierrez in English. Later in the encounter, Mr. Wessner entered the room. Mr. Wessner had been participating in the protective sweep, so he wasn't there for the first part of the discussion. Mr. Wessner speaks both Spanish and English, and when he came into the room, he posed a question to Mr. Gutierrez in Spanish, and Mr. Gutierrez answered in Spanish. And so from that point on, they were conversing in both languages. But again, both agents testified about that both at the suppression hearing and at trial, and there was no question concerning the ability to communicate. If, of course, Mr. Gutierrez had some strong preference for one language or the other, it would have been clear to him that there were agents speaking both languages there, so he could have made a choice. But that wasn't part of the encounter. There was some reference by defense counsel to the encounter becoming more and more coercive or more stressful as it went on. I think the evidence more properly characterized shows that the agents were taking steps to make it less stressful in terms of their discussions with Mr. Gutierrez. For example, after they do find cocaine on his person, after the consensual search, Agent Hartnett explains to the defendant, I'm going to put handcuffs on you so that I can search the rest of your person to see if there's any contraband. He does that within seconds. Once that's finished, they take the handcuffs back off and have him sit down so they can talk to him about what steps they're going to do next.
Of course, the amount they find on him is something that might be a personal use quantity, right?
That's true.
Just a gram, unlike what they eventually find.
Yes, that's correct. As to the discussion concerning the search warrant, there was never any implication that I recall at the district court level that by talking to the defendant about consent or about getting a warrant, there was some implication that if you sign, we'll just let you go. That was never any part of the context of the discussion. The notion that the agent should have immediately terminated this, put him under arrest, and gone off with the 1 gram of cocaine, it doesn't make sense. I mean, the agents, once they found that, and you know, they were looking at this residence, as the record shows, as part of a larger investigation, they continued to ask questions, and that's why they asked the defendant for consent to search.
I'm not concerned about this, thinking that they were going to let him go if he consented, but what was said precisely about the search warrant?
What Agent Hartnett said to Mr. Gutierrez was that if he refused to consent, these are the steps he would take. And I'm not saying verbatim, but my recollection of the testimony from the suppression hearing is that if he did not agree to consent, here are the steps that they would take. He would contact the assistant United States attorney, and he would describe what had been found at the residence, and he would ask the assistant United States attorney to prepare a search warrant application. That application would go to a judge, and the judge would decide whether or not a warrant would issue.
If that's the state of the record, that's terrific. It's wrong if they were to say, we will get a search warrant if you don't consent, because they don't know if a judge would approve a search warrant.
That's correct.
But the record here will support that what they said was, we would apply, and we will tell the U.S. attorney what we know, and with that information, it'll be put in an application for a warrant, and a judge will decide whether to issue it. That's what you say the record will substantiate here.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the site for that is at record 72-1 at pages 90 and 91, 96, and 118. If there are no further questions, we ask that the court affirm both the conviction and the sentence of Mr. Gutierrez.
All right. Thank you. I think your time had expired, so we will take the case under advisement.